This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 19 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me tonight is Mike Morrison. In this episode, we'll be discussing hermeneutics, or the study of meaning and interpretation in Star Trek. We'll be talking about the meaning and interpretation of particular examples inside the Star Trek universe, and we'll be talking about the meaning and interpretation of the Star Trek franchise as a whole from our contemporary perspective here in the 21st century. Well, Mike, welcome to the show tonight. I hope you're having a good day, and I know talking about hermeneutics was your idea here for the show tonight, so I'm anxious to hear about what's on your mind about hermeneutics.
Well, Zachary, this is the conversation that started it all for us, and let's go back in time a little bit to the second, I believe it was the second Patrons Roundtable you and I were on when we first met. You and I have never met face-to-face, but, you know, we get together each week here across subspace. But on that first, or actually second Patrons Roundtable, there was a brief conversation about hermeneutics. And that, I think, is the conversation where you and I kind of connected in terms of our thoughts and ideas. And here we are, 19 episodes later, doing Metatrex, talking about Star Trek and philosophy. I'm really looking forward to it.
It's that second Patron Roundtable when we discovered we were brothers from another incubation pod.
Maturation chamber, yes. Yes.
Maturation chamber, yeah.
Yes. I was trying to remember. I was having difficulty remembering, but it does occur to me that you contacted me and you said, "Hey, Mike, let's do a podcast together. Resistance is futile."
Did I put it in those terms? I can't quite remember. I might have. Like, there's no choice. It's not optional. You're being assimilated. You're going to be my co-host, whether you like it or not. Resistance is futile.
Yeah. Nah, but you know, seriously though, this was the conversation that kind of started it all, and. I think it's very relevant right now because, as most of our listeners, I think, are aware, we have been doing here on the network kind of a 50th anniversary rewatch of Star Trek, and we've been celebrating that through another podcast here on Trek FM called From There to Here. And I want to invite our listeners, if you haven't checked that out, to do so. They're brief episodes, usually less than 20 minutes long, 10, 15, 20 minutes. Where they will preview two episodes as part of that rewatch. And so we're getting a chance as a network to kind of rediscover Star Trek. And it's interesting because it's sparked some conversation out there on the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listener-only discussion group. And it's really been fascinating to kind of look at those discussions as they're happening and how we look at Star Trek. Here we are 50 years later, and right now we're I think we're about halfway through, as we're recording this, the first season of the original series. And it's interesting, you know, how we're re-examining that series and rediscovering it, you know, trying to determine what it meant at the time, and certainly what it means to us now. And those two things don't always line up. So we're going to talk about that here in the episode today, I'm sure.
Well, I think you're right that there's no better time to circle back and start asking the question about the meaning of Star Trek as a whole, especially given that it's the 50th anniversary of Star Trek on television. And I think that's one thing that really kind of defines Star Trek as a franchise for me. It's something I can always circle back and continue to find new meaning and get new value out of every time I circle back and watch an episode. could be an episode I've watched 20 times or 100 times. I can always find new meaning, things I didn't notice in the episode for sure, but I can also find new application in my own life as I gain more and more experience, have just different experiences, different trials and errors, different things that come and go in life. I find new meaning in those classic episodes. And I'm just looking forward to talking about meaning in Star Trek tonight.
Yeah, I feel the same way. That for me is what makes Star Trek so different from any other franchise. And I'm a fan of many pop culture franchises out there. I'm a Star Wars fan, but you know, for me, what really makes Star Trek unique is the fact that I've often referred to it as a thinker's science fiction. And so, you know, these episodes oftentimes deal with subjects that have deeper meaning. And it's fascinating to me that I can watch, for instance, an episode of the Next Generation, and I can circle back around a year, 2 years later and watch it again. And the meaning of that particular episode might take on new meaning for me based on where I'm at in my life or what my thought processes are at that particular time. It could be what's going on in the world around me at that moment in time. And then there's just the simple fact that as we mature, I think oftentimes it just peels new layers of meaning in what we take in around us. So I think this is going to be a fascinating discussion. And by the way, Zachary, there are some really good examples, not just Star Trek as a whole and how we interpret it, what it meant then compared to what it means now, but there are also some really good examples within the Star Trek universe of hermeneutics in action, if you will, within the episodes, and we'll talk about those as well.
You know, as part of the From There to Here Trek FM podcast, where we're rewatching all of Star Trek, I'm rewatching currently some of the original series episodes. And if you get past the kind of 1960s veneer on those original episodes, and there is some 1960s veneer, right? You know, the colors and the sets and whatnot. If you can get past all of that, you realize that Star Trek deals with some very timeless, universal human issues. And of course, those issues are being dealt with in the context of the issues that are going on in the 1960s. You know, carrying on into the 1980s, if you can get past the 1980s veneer on the Enterprise D, and of course, it literally is a veneer on the Enterprise D, right? You know, the USS Hilton. But if you can get past that, you realize that Star Trek gets at these really timeless issues. And then at every generation, every new batch of humans, right, you know, is sort of thrown into the world. There's issues that they didn't make. There's kind of a long-term trajectory of human history. And those universal principles have to be kind of applied to a particular situation and re-examined and reinterpreted. Every generation, every individual has to do that in the course of his or her lifetime. Every generation has to do that in their place in the world. And I think that's what's interesting about Star Trek to me. It really is this intersection of these universal ideals and principles and issues, and all of which is wrapped up with the way that the author, the screenwriters and Gene Roddenberry thought about the world, the kind of the vision they created of what human nature could be, the context in which those original episodes were written. Put that together with our contemporary setting today, and there's plenty of material to go back and keep reexamining the meaning of Star Trek as a whole in light of our contemporary situation. And I have no doubt that, you know, that every generation of fans is going to continue to keep re-examining those original episodes and find new meaning and find new messages and find new applications of those principles for their own lives.
Yeah. I wish our listeners had the opportunity to see what I'm seeing right now. You know, on my monitor here, I've got one of my windows open, and I can see our editor and producer down here, Dennis, and you're there on my screen. And as you're talking, you're already starting to draw your Venn diagrams. So
well, everyone who knows that I like Venn diagrams, any excuse to draw one. So
yeah, well, this is a topic that actually lends itself to Venn diagramming, and so I found it comical that you know, as you're talking, you're already sitting there drawing them out. in the air.
Well, that's a natural segue to start talking about the meaning of hermeneutics. You know, it's a word we haven't really defined yet for the listeners. You know, we've used it a couple of other times on Metatrex, and even if you go back to the discussion we had on the Patrons Roundtable number two, this topic came up. Hermeneutics is essentially the I would say the art and science of textual interpretation, the meaning of a text or the meaning. And in the context of television, it doesn't have to be like a strictly speaking a text, like words on the page, like a book or a scripture or anything like that. It could be the meaning of what you're seeing on the screen in any sort of medium. Art, there's a hermeneutics as it relates to art, hermeneutics as it relates to film and television. But the questions of meaning and interpretation, how should a piece of art or a written work be interpreted? You know, what is the original intention of that work? What new meaning can be found based on the contemporary interpretations or subjective interpretations? So yeah, you're right. I kind of am drawing a Venn diagram here. On the one side, the meaning of a piece of work is the original intention, the original meaning of the words, the original artist's or the original author's intentions. But the other side of the Venn diagram is the subjective or cultural or social interpretation from a more contemporary setting. And so if you ask what's the meaning of a piece of art, you know, it's not just that the meaning is restricted to the original intentions of the creators. That's a very limited if that were the case, that would be a very limited sense of meaning. It would preclude the possibility of finding new meaning and new interpretations down the road. And clearly we can do that. So on the other hand, you don't want to be you don't want it to be so subjective that any random interpretation, any subjective interpretation counts as a plausible interpretation. Mm-hmm. So really when you're talking about the meaning of a piece of art or a text or a piece of work, a Star Trek episode, whatever the example is, the meaning is really the combination of both. It's the intersection of the artist's original intentions combined with whatever new meaning we can find in the present. And these serve to constrain each other. You know, the art, you don't want to have such a radical interpretation that you ignore the author's original intentions in creating the work. That would allow for too broad of a field of possible interpretations that are probably implausible. On the other hand, you don't want to be so constrained by the artist's original intentions that you don't find new meaning. So reality is somewhere in the middle. So it's not exactly a Venn diagram, but it's Venn diagram like that. The meaning of a piece of work, sure, work of art is the interplay between, you know, the artist speaking to you and you, the receiver, kind of speaking back to the artist in some sort of conversational sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I noticed here that you had a note in our discussion outline, and if I missed it when you were talking, I apologize. But I think it's important to say that hermeneutics gets its name, interestingly enough, from Hermes, the messenger god. He was the one who carried messages from Mount Olympus.
Yeah, I don't think this is as terribly important to talk about the meaning of hermeneutics in some practical sense. Like when we talk about the hermeneutics of Star Trek, we don't need to talk about Hermes, the messenger god, right?
No, it's important to remember.
It's a nice way to remember the meaning of the word hermeneutics, right? Hermeneutics, it's kind of a big, scary word, hermeneutics. How do you spell that even, right? Well, if you remember that it comes from Hermes, the messenger god, that can help you remember the meaning of the word hermeneutics. You know, Hermes, hermeneutics literally tries to address the question, what is the message, right?
What is the message?
What is the message? What is the message of this book? What's the message of this text? What's the message of this TV show? What's the message of this movie? What's the message of this political document? What's the message of this email, right? So it's a very broad discipline that can be applied to any number of different things, but it's all about meaning. What's the message? What's the meaning? What's the interpretation? And then trying to, you know, find the intersection between the original intentions and the original meaning and whatever new meaning it has for you or your culture in today.
And whether people realize it or not, I think many of us, anytime we watch a television show or we read a book, you know, I'm probably more inclined these days to watch something on TV, but I also very much enjoy reading. And so anytime I'm reading, anytime I'm watching something, especially when it's something like Star Trek, the original series that, you know, dates back to the 1960s, I'm a lover of old movies. Matter of fact, my favorite movie of all time, It's a Wonderful Life. I love those old World War II movies from the 1950s. I occasionally can get into a Western, you know, from the 60s or 70s, John Wayne, Rooster Cogburn. You know, I love True Grit, the original and not the remake. I just want to clarify that. But anytime we're watching something, we ask ourselves questions such as, you know, what did this mean at the time it was written? What was the intention of the author when they wrote this? For instance, Of Mice and Men, one of my favorite books, John Steinbeck. And, you know, you ask yourself the question, you know, what was Steinbeck's original intention when he wrote this? What was the message? What was the philosophy that he was getting across? What was the story about? And then you kind of filter that through where you're at in whatever contemporary situation you're in, whether you're, you know, in my case, I read Of Mice and Men as a middle school student in the 1980s, you know, 1980s, Cold War, you know, what did this mean to a teenager in the 1980s? And what does it mean to me as a 45-year-old adult now? And so that, in essence, is hermeneutics, asking yourself, what does this mean? What did it mean to the author then? What does it mean to me now? And we certainly do that with Star Trek. And I think to a small degree, Zachary, that's what From There to Here and the 50th anniversary rewatch that we're doing around the network, that's what it's all about.
Well, I think as it relates to Star Trek, I think one common thing I've seen is to continually return to Gene Roddenberry's original intention. What is Gene Roddenberry's vision of the universe? What are his ideals? Mm-hmm. What are his view of mankind and the possibilities for mankind? And on the one hand, I'm simultaneously kind of glad that people keep going back to the original source. On the other hand, I find it a little limiting. On the one hand, it is important to ask those questions, right? What was the original artist's intention? What was the context mm-hmm. in which the original work was created? How is that work understood by the original creator? How is that work understood by the original receivers of that material, right? The first viewers of Star Trek, what did they get out of seeing Star Trek on TV for the first time in the 1960s Cold War setting? On the other hand, that's not all of the meaning of Star Trek, right? We can watch Star Trek now and we can say, something we see in an episode of the original series or in The Next Generation, that could be seen as a metaphor for a contemporary situation now. There's lessons we can learn that are applied to our own lives or applied to the contemporary world situation. So you don't want to be constrained by the original artist's intention. But what you don't want to do is read the contemporary situation back into the original work, right? For example, right. A lot of our political world these days is defined by the relationship between, you know, the Western world and the Middle East, right? That is the contemporary situation. It's different from the Cold War situation. You don't want to read that necessarily back into the original series, right? You might be able to find elements of the original series that are relevant to analyzing the contemporary world situation, but it would be a mistake to say that, you know, part of the original meaning of Star Trek was, you know, like they were foreshadowing, had some foreknowledge of what was to come in world events or anything like that, right? That would be sort of reading backwards in retrospect, almost revisionist history. Mm-hmm. So it is important to make kind of a dividing line between, you know, what the artist's original intention was and what the original context was, the original meaning was, and then always being really aware when you're reading backwards, you know, from your contemporary situation back into looking at an original work through your contemporary lens. And I think there's always a danger. I think there's always a gap between you and the original creator, even in the contemporary world. I mean, suppose someone writes even right now we're in a situation where there's a new Star Trek movie about to be released in a couple of months. There's a new Star Trek TV series coming in 2017, just a handful of months away now. What is it? I feel like I should have like notches on the wall, like, you know, keep counting off the days. How many days is it until the new Star Trek series? So what is it? It's into February, beginning of March. So, T-minus 9 months, right?
Let's just call it
10 months.
Nine months, the next number of days.
So, Mike, I have no doubt that there's a conversation going on about the new Star Trek TV series going on right now that we're not privy to. Like, even in the contemporary situation, there's a gap between us, the receiver of whatever content is coming, and you know, the content creators. So that aside, if you add the time factor in, like if you go back and say, you know, what was the gap between us and the writers on Star Trek The Next Generation? Okay, now it's a gap of, you know, creeping up on 30 years, right? So it's very difficult for us as the content viewers to wrap our minds around what was in the original authors' heads. So there's always this gap you have to overcome. You know, like you mentioned Steinbeck earlier. What was Steinbeck's intention in writing something, right? Mm-hmm. Well, all we can do is guess. We have the words on the page. We have the history we've learned. We've got other people who've written about it, and that's the best we can do. So you'll never really understand exactly for sure for all time with certainty what was in an artist's mind. Even in the contemporary situation, I think that's true, much less if you had the time factor in. But it is important just to be aware of that time factor. So I can't necessarily put my head in the artist's mindset. And on the other hand, you know, I've got my own biases, I've got my own prejudices, you know, all this background assumption that makes up, you know, who I am as a person. Everyone is like this. You know, you've got your own biases, your own prejudices, your own assumptions, your own worldview.
Sure.
And it's very easy to kind of, you know, take all of that you know, heavy worldview and read it back into the original creator's intentions. And so it is important, I think, when you're looking at the meaning of something, to really, as much as possible, and you can never do this perfectly, I think, but to try to separate your own worldview and your own biases from your perceptions of what the artist's original intentions or worldview or understanding or message might have been. And of course, I think it's a little imperfect. You know, in a perfect world, you'd be able to really radically separate these two. But practically speaking, you can't get yourself totally outside your own perspective and your own context and your own worldview. So you can do that to a degree. I think, you know, you can do this to various degrees. You can do it better or worse, right? You can totally try to, you know, if I was going to read, a reading of Star Trek from my, you know, relatively middle-class white guy, 37-year-old perspective from Vacaville, California, right? And that's my interpretation of Star Trek. You know, that's a fairly limiting perspective on the meaning of Star Trek. On the other hand, I can be aware of those things and I can say, okay, here's some other things that were going on in the 1960s culturally or historically, and I can learn about those. I can try to bracket my own assumptions. I can get closer and closer and closer to understanding what the original intention, I'm thinking specifically of Gene Roddenberry. What was Gene Roddenberry's original intention in creating Star Trek? I can get closer and closer to that, I think, as I become more and more aware of my own biases, but I can't do it perfectly.
Yeah. And we do this every time we introduce a new iteration of Star Trek. When Gene sat down with his creative team to reimagine Star Trek for, are you ready for this? A new generation. I'm sure that there were these conversations going on in which, you know, they were saying to themselves, well, you know, this is what Star Trek meant in, you know, 1968. But here, you know, here we are in, it's, you know, 1987, and, you know, we're going to reimagine, or we're going to bring Star Trek in and rethink this and retool this, you know, for a new generation. And then, you know, you have Deep Space Nine, you have Voyager, and then ultimately you have Enterprise, and, you know, very soon we'll have Star Trek 2017, the powers that be decide that's going to be. And so each time we reimagine Star Trek, we have to go back to the original source material and ask ourselves the question, what was the original intent? And, you know, how can we, you know, reimagine this for a new time? And again, here we're talking to some degree about hermeneutics.
See, now I'm thinking that the Star Trek 2017 should be called, you know, Star Trek, the Young Whippersnappers. You know, not Star Trek The Next Generation, Star Trek The Grandkids.
The Young Bucks.
Something like that, right?
And, you know, it's interesting to me because we do, each of us, I think, look back on Star Trek and we see it in different ways based on our own experiences and you know, who we are and what it means. It means something, I'm sure, different to me, and I'm going back to the original series, something different to me than, you know, perhaps it does you, Zachary, because, you know, there's a few years, you know, separating us. And, you know, I can even go back to someone who was maybe a teenager in 1968, who's got a couple of years on me. I'm sure sees all of that in a different light as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have family members that were just a little bit too old to be interested in Star Trek on its first run. You know, they were already, you know, in their early 20s by the time 1966 rolled around. And they just didn't kind of get that connection to it. And, you know, even if they're interested in science fiction in other ways, they just don't latch on to it because they, for some reason, they just didn't get that formative experience that latched them onto it. And so, you know, how's that related to hermeneutics? They just don't find the meaning in it that I do. It's, yeah. You know, I had that sort of early formative experience with it, you know, as a kid, in my case, you know, watching the original series with my dad. And then, of course, being a teenager when The Next Generation was on. And because of that formative experience, it's something I do kind of habitually circle back to. And I got in the habit of doing that. But if, you know, there are books I read in elementary school or in junior high school or high school that I didn't connect with. And what happens is I don't actually circle back to those very often. I have no doubt that if I did actually circle back and give them a reread, I would find the meaning there. But there's a lot of works that I just don't find myself circling back to. Other franchises besides Star Trek that I don't circle back to nearly as much. So there's something unique for me about Star Trek that, and maybe it's just more fruitful. Maybe it was just because I was young and impressionable when I watched Star Trek. Maybe because it speaks to my ideals. But I do find myself circling back to Star Trek in this hermeneutical kind of way more than for other things. And I don't really have an explanation for why. I'm sure you probably have you know, a similar experience there. And many Star Trek fans probably have a similar experience that they circle back to Star Trek in particular for some reason. You know, on the other hand, I find it interesting, but I don't find it terribly interesting. Like, yeah, I'm just one guy, right? So who cares what I think about Star Trek? You know, however much we have to say on Metatrex, I'm still only one guy. So who cares what I think, right? But I do find it interesting that structurally Star Trek has this viewing pattern where people do regularly rewatch Star Trek. In fact, you know, this doesn't even phase us. We rewatch Star Trek, right? Whereas if you use that phrase for any for many other franchises, like I'm going to rewatch Alf this month, and I'm going to make that my focus this year. I'm rewatching Alf, all, you know, 60 something episodes of Alf, whatever, however many there were. You know, that just wouldn't speak to us in the same way that rewatching Star Trek does. There's a reverence to it, and I don't know why that is, but I think there is this structural viewing pattern that Star Trek fans have about rewatching that lends itself to a hermeneutical discussion.
Well, it's interesting, and I think you make an excellent point. And all joking about Alpha side, I do. I think there's something unique about Star Trek. I can't think of another franchise, and I know that there are some other fan groups out there and pop culture groups out there, and you know, Star Trek certainly isn't the only franchise that's having, you know, these conventions. They're not the only ones that have fan. It's not the only group that has, or the only franchise that has fan groups out there, but Star Trek, it just invokes something very deep within people. And I think that goes back to, you know, the philosophy and the ideals. And I don't want to get off the subject of hermeneutics, Zachary, but what you and I are doing right here, first of all, is very unique to Star Trek. I can't think of another podcast out there that discusses Star Trek and philosophy. But of all the science fiction or, you know, other genres of franchise, of entertainment franchises out there, I can't think of another one that lends itself so much to philosophical thought and, you know, hermeneutical technique as Star Trek does.
Well, speaking of that, let's dive in and talk about some actual examples of hermeneutics in action inside Star Trek.
Sure.
You know, as I was thinking about hermeneutics before the show today, it occurred to me that oftentimes the word hermeneutics is used in a religious context in the sense of interpreting religious texts. You know, there's a biblical hermeneutics. I think, you know, for anyone who grew up as a in theology circles, and you know, Mike's raising his hand. this is a phrase that these phrases are often paired together. It's not just hermeneutics; it's biblical hermeneutics, right? It's the meaning of some sacred historical text. And the thing is, you get this inside Star Trek, right? And I'm thinking specifically of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, in which the Bajorans have their texts and their prophecies and their culture. And there's a continual sort of hermeneutical question in universe of circling back and asking about, and reexamining the meaning, asking the question about what is the meaning of these prophecies or what's the meaning of these historical texts. I'm thinking of an example, specifically I'm thinking of Deep Space Nine episode The Reckoning, in which they find an ancient stone tablet mentioning the emissary. And of course, they have to translate the tablet. And then they have to ask, this is a new prophecy. What does it mean, right? In light of what's happening here on, yes. On the space station. That's, the fundamental hermeneutical question. What does this thing mean? And oftentimes these discussions come up in the context of religious interpretation and interpreting historical texts. And this happens all over the place inside Deep Space Nine in particular. Before the show, I was thinking of different examples of prophecies inside of Deep Space Nine. I put together a little list of prophecies in Deep Space Nine. There are these really broad questions you can ask, these fundamental hermeneutical questions about the in-universe worldview of the Bajorans and how it relates to what's happening inside Deep Space Nine. Broad questions like, is Sisko really the emissary of the prophets? You know, should these texts be interpreted mm-hmm. to mean that Sisko is the emissary? Already, that's an interpretation, you know, and not even everyone agrees. At the beginning of Deep Space Nine, it's not obvious that that's true, right? Eventually, I think in through the course of Deep Space Nine, that becomes a more and more plausible view to have. Other questions include things like, you know, how about the wormhole? You know, the wormhole is interpreted as the celestial temple inside Bajoran prophecy.
Right.
But again, that's an interpretation, right? The word celestial temple doesn't mean wormhole, right? That could mean any number of different things, different phenomena in space. Could mean something terrestrial on Bajor. You know, who knows what it means, right? Could be purely metaphorical in some sort of spiritual sense. But, you know, the in universe now, they have interpreted the phrase celestial temple to mean the Bajoran wormhole. And so, you know, at a very fundamental level, these spiritual texts have to be interpreted in a hermeneutical way. You can't just read the meaning out of these texts literally because they're replete with metaphors. So you have to keep circling back and saying, what does this mean? What does this mean? And then you have a question of, you know, is this interpretation plausible? Is it really the most plausible interpretation of those texts that Sisko is the emissary? Is it the most plausible interpretation of the phrase celestial temple that it refers to the Bajoran wormhole? Mm-hmm. And does this sort of help the understanding? Is it well grounded in the original text, or is this a purely subjective, often left field interpretation that isn't plausible? And any religion where there's sacred text, I think, is going to have this issue, where you circle back to the text and try to interpret them in the most plausible way. But you can never just read the meaning straight off the page as if there's no interpretive element to it.
Yeah, and you know, I think about and Deep Space Nine lends itself so well to this conversation. I think about the episode Destiny from, I think, the third season of Deep Space Nine, in which, again, these crazy Bajoran prophecies have yet again been invoked to shed some kind of meaning or some kind of light on what's going on in the life of the station. These Cardassian scientists have gotten involved in a project, and you know that they're this sword of stars. What does that mean? A sword of stars, and so you know they ultimately come to interpret that as meaning this comet. And I don't want to get into a whole retrospect of this episode, but it's interesting how you can take something in a prophetical text, and it's a sort of stars. And what does that mean? Oh, well, there happens to be a comet. Well, maybe that's what it means. But it's interesting because you always have that one guy, you know, that one guy who's, you know, slams his fist down and it's a comet. That's what it means. But we don't know, you know, until we ask some questions and try to apply. And then it's just an educated guess. At very best, when you're dealing with interpretation of something ancient like that. And then you have the literalist who literally thinks it's a sword made of stars. And so there's no way that comet could be the sword of stars because it's going to be a literal sword made out of stars. So you've got different ways of looking at this, and I think Destiny is an excellent episode to examine the idea of hermeneutics in the Star Trek universe.
You know, it occurred to me as you were talking that there's a relationship between this interpretive hermeneutical element within a particular religion, including the Bajoran religion, and the political structure that supports those interpretations. So I'm thinking now, if you have a religion whose organization is hierarchical, like, you know, if in Christianity, it might be the Catholic Church or the Episcopal Church, mm-hmm. right? Something that's very hierarchical. And Bajorans are like that. They have a leader, the Kai. And there's Vedics, and there's kind of a hierarchy there. You know, if you have a hierarchy with someone at the head of that, there is room to say there is one and only one canonical interpretation, and it comes from above, right? It's the Kai's job to be the final word on how to interpret those Bajoran texts or those Bajoran prophecies. Just like in the Catholic Church, you know, it's the Pope's job to interpret, you know, whatever scriptural texts or whatever prophecies, sure. right? You know, this is something that comes from on high. As opposed to, in Christianity, would be opposed to a more Protestant democratic organizational hierarchy, Presbyterians or maybe not so much Lutherans, but evangelicals or, Methodists, they have a very sort of bottom up hierarchy, right? They, and those, when you have kind of a bottom up level playing field, there's a lot more room for competing interpretations, I think. And yeah. you can see this in the Protestant world in Christianity, where you see just competing interpretations. You know, there's fundamentalists and there's evangelicals mm-hmm. and then there's the Presbyterians, and they, you know, different denominations will disagree about which portions of the Bible should be literal and which should be metaphorical and whatnot. And there's just this very broad set of competing interpretations. But you don't really see that in the Bajoran religion because it's hierarchical, right? There might be some competing groups. I'm thinking of the Pa Wraith cult, right? It might be a competing interpretation of Bajoran scripture, right? They have a different interpretation of what those prophecies mean and what the final result will be and whatnot. So there's a couple of these offshoots, but there's not really a very wide field of competing interpretations in the Bajoran religion, at least not from what I can tell in watching Deep Space Nine.
I think you're exactly right, Zachary. You know, when you talk about these different, if you will, sects, and since we're using Christianity, you have the top down, like we see probably the best example would be the Catholic Church, and then you have, you know, more of the bottom up, like you would see in many Protestant sects of Christianity. And so I'm thinking that there are potential issues with both of those in regards to at least interpreting scripture. When you have a top down, well, you have this problem with top down and bottom up sort of interpretation, at least the approach to interpretation. And the problem is, for instance, with popes, as it is in the Star Trek universe with the Kai, a different Kai comes along and you have a different perspective, a different way of looking at those. Early on, one of the issues with Vedic Wynne was that she was a member of a very, very conservative, very strict sect. And so there was a consensus that, perhaps she wouldn't be a good choice for Kai, because after all, the Bajoran people are about to take a bold step forward and join, you know, the greater interstellar community. And, you know, perhaps someone like Vedic Barile would be a better choice to, lead the, at least be the spiritual leader of the Bajoran people, because he was a little bit more progressive. And so you have that same problem in the world we live in, right? You've got, we have what I think now is a bit more progressive Pope. And we've seen, at least here recently, that there's certainly been some controversy over his spin, his take on things. And we see a lot of drama, a lot of infighting, if you will, in the Protestant organizations, because, you know, we're debating and talking about, the meaning of scripture in our world today. And we saw this happen, you know, throughout Deep Space Nine during its run. You know, we're looking at these texts, we're looking at these prophecies, and we're asking questions, and, you know, we're trying to find meaning. You know, when we look at, for instance, we look at, Trekor's third prophecy, you know, when the river wakes, I'm reading the note here, stirred once more to Jenir's side, three vipers will return to their nest in the sky. When the vipers try to peer through the temple gates, a sword of stars will appear in the heavens. The temple will burn and the gates shall be cast open. And so, you know, during the time Trekor wrote this, you know, what was going on with the Bajoran people, what was going on in the world around him. And, you know, here we are, however many thousand of years later, looking at this and trying to discover meaning and trying to apply it to the situation that we're in. And perhaps it applies and perhaps it doesn't. And even at the end of the episode, it's interesting because that last conversation that takes place, you know, they're admitting that, you know, while we may have been wrong on the interpretation, maybe after all it meant this. And so they change their meaning and they kind of bend that prophecy to sort of fit the situation that they were in. And we see that in the world that we live in. And that really is, you know, kind of taking a literary analysis of it. And then, you know, we kind of analyze the context and we throw out the historical analysis, the cultural analysis, and we just, you know, we find the metaphor and we apply it to the moment. And I'm thinking there's a little bit of a danger in that. The danger is that we apply meaning to something that never should have been there. And I think we do that with Star Trek sometimes as well, especially when we look at, and I think you made the point earlier, we look at, for instance, you know, the Klingons in the original series, and we look at the, you know, the Romulans, and we know because we can go back and we can read the notes. We know what Roddenberry's original intents were with those species. But now, you know, now we've kind of muddy that water a little bit because we live in different times, and gee, those Romulans, you know, they look a little bit more like, you know, these people. And we need to be careful when we do that, that we don't read meaning into it that really isn't there.
You know, I don't want to spend too much time talking about the real world. I did want to circle back and keep talking about hermeneutics inside Star Trek. But you mentioned something that's really interesting to me. I've had lots of experiences of interacting with religious people. And of course, I'm a person of faith myself to various degrees and at various times. But I've encountered people who have more of a fundamentalist, literalist kind of interpretation of their religion. And it's a fascinating discussion because at the same time, those people make a very conscious effort to keep going back to the original text. They're Bible readers, and they've got a certain interpretation of mm-hmm. what everything means. And, you know, they really sort of claim to be sort of fundamentalist, literalist, you know, by the book kind of religious people. And at the same time, without fail, there are certain elements that are obviously metaphorical or obviously interpretive inside those scriptures, where they'll have a very sort of a perspective about what the one canonical interpretation should be, mm-hmm. and then appeal to the words themselves on the page. And I'll be reading the same passage and I'll say, that's not what it says at all. you know, it's almost like they've forgotten that there's this interpretive element. Like, you know, here's the words on the page. Here's what the literal words mean. Like, I'm thinking of a phrase from one of these Bajoran prophecies. In fact, the one you just read, you know, three vipers will return to their nest in the sky, right? If you read that literally, we're talking about three literal vipers in the literal sky, right? That if the meaning isn't just the literal word by word meaning, then we're talking about something metaphorical, right? Those vipers represent something, and the sky represents something. The nest in the sky represents something else, right? And you know, a believer in the Bajoran worldview might think, you know, well, that the correct meaning, the Kai Wynn, might think, well, the way that should be interpreted is that the vipers mean this, and the nest means this, and the sky means this, and that's the one correct interpretation. But in saying that's the one correct interpretation, it's very easy to forget that that itself is an interpretation, that those are metaphors, and it's an open question what they really do refer to. And then what you can do, you can start asking these hermeneutical questions. What was the original context in which that was written? What would those terms have meant to the original people who read those words, you know, back in ancient days when the prophecies were written? And then you can ask, what does it mean for us now? What's the contemporary situation? You know, now we have wormholes and space stations, right? You know, how can we reinterpret the meaning of those texts in light of, you know, these new terms that we have now that the ancient world didn't have? But it's an inherently hermeneutical discussion, right? But for believers themselves, I think it's very easy to forget that there's this interpretive element. You can appeal to the text as if the meaning is there hidden in the text somewhere, but really that's an interpretation through and through. But I guess the middle ground, the sort of hermeneutical middle ground that I see is that there are more or less plausible interpretations, right? If your interpretation is self-contradictory mm-hmm. or isn't fruitful or contradicts other things you believe, then that interpretation is not going to be a terribly plausible interpretation. So there is this spectrum of more or less plausible interpretations. But even on the most fundamentalist, literalist worldview, the most conservative Kai in Deep Space Nine would have to, looking at it from the outside, you'd have to say, well, there's this interpretive element. All these prophecies, especially in Deep Space Nine, are highly metaphorical. In fact, I put together a list of some of these phrases. I just want to read some of these phrases just to show how metaphorical these prophecies are. This is not terribly metaphorical, but there's this one discussion between Dax and Sisko in Deep Space Nine, The Reckoning, in which Dax says that the inscription on the tablet that they find says, "During the reckoning, the Bajorans are either going to suffer horribly or eat fruit."
Yes.
Yeah, and I love that because, you have one word and it's not exactly clear what the symbol means. Could be suffer horribly, which is a little more literal. Suffer horribly is not terribly metaphorical, but
sure.
Eat fruit, what does that mean, right? If that were the correct interpretation, that's highly metaphorical. So what the heck does eat fruit mean? I've got a list here. So I've got Shabron's fifth prophecy. Bajor will be reborn. Again, not in some literal sense, right? That's a nonsensical phrase if it's a purely literal meaning. So what does it mean to be reborn in this Bajoran sense, right? That's an interpretive question. I've got Taunut's prophecy of the final days. Here's a quote. "And the land shall be poisoned by a great evil. The poison must be purged away so the land can be reborn." A lot of stuff about being reborn here. But again, what does that mean, right? The land being reborn is a nonsensical literal phrase. It's almost like asking how high is up, right? It doesn't sound... Or like I'm thinking like Jabberwocky, right? That's a nonsensical poem that sounds like real language. And, the land will be reborn. Yeah, it's grammatically correct, but literally it doesn't mean very much at all. So you're forced into this interpretive metaphorical interpretation of these prophecies. I've got Trakor's fourth prophecy. "The emissary will face a fiery trial and he will be forced to choose." Okay, a fiery trial. Is that a literal fire? In some sense, that ends up being true in Deep Space Nine. It ends up being a little more literal. But again, that could be interpreted metaphorically. So we don't really know. The believers
sure.
Of the Bajoran religion and Sisko as the emissary, they're forced to ask, what does this phrase mean?
But back to Trakor's third prophecy, when we're talking about three vipers returning to their nest, Zachary, everyone knows that before the Cardassians were referred to as spoonheads or Cardies, they were known as vipers because they look like cobras. Trakor saw a Cardassian. He said, "My God, it's a viper." And we all know he was talking about Cardassians when he wrote Three Vipers.
Right. That reminds me of the episode from Voyager, Dragon's Teeth, I think it's called, in which there's this name of one of the species is Vaudoir.
Vaudoir, yes.
And Vaudoir. And of course, that's the name of the species. But in the Talaxian language, in the old Talaxian language, that meant foolish or,
yes.
or whatnot. So that's what's interesting. The way language certainly evolves. I mean, without a doubt, the words we have mean something different than they did in times past. New shades of meaning. At very least, there's new words altogether. I mean, especially with this technological culture, and you see this in Star Trek, this in a rich technological culture, you're going to have word after word after word, new terms invented mm-hmm. to refer to all this technological stuff, right? All the technobabble that you see inside Star Trek is an example of evolving language. But a lot of the time, it doesn't change so much you can't identify with what the word used to mean. I think, there's a change, but oftentimes it's not a radical change. There's a gradual shift in meaning, or even if there's a radical shift, it's not like we forgot what the original meaning was, especially for languages where there's a rich history of the language. I'm thinking of things like Greek and Latin
yes.
and whatnot. If ancient Bajoran has a similar sort of cultural history where it's well known what the original meaning of these words was, you can give a more or less plausible interpretation of what the language used to mean. And I think, this causes some controversy amongst people, who are interpreting ancient texts. On the one hand, you could say, well, language changes so much. How could you ever know what the original language was? And then it's a question of, well, how much did the language actually change? And how much did the shades of meaning change? Did we forget for some reason what the language used to mean? Like with Egyptian, Egyptian was an example of a language where literally it was forgotten what the language
right.
meant, right? The whole language was
yes.
gone. No one could understand it anymore. No one could read it. And we had to rediscover what that what the symbols in that language meant.
Yeah, as someone who studied Koine Greek in college, you know, Koine is a dead language, and I'm telling you, it's dead for a good reason. It's a very difficult, very nuanced language, and so. And that just kind of lends itself to what you're saying there. Language is fickle, for lack of a better way of putting it.
So I guess my question is ancient Bajoran like that? Has the language been forgotten to the point where we literally don't know whether a symbol means, you know, we'll suffer greatly or to eat fruit? Those are pretty radical interpretations, right?
It's pretty radical interpretations.
And I guess we don't really know. We're not given enough information in universe, but what's interesting to me is the many different ways you can circle back and have these hermeneutical discussions, right? We were just talking about the meaning of individual terms inside of a language. And I have put together a list of different kind of hermeneutical techniques, different ways you can have a hermeneutical discussion asking about the meaning of something. So I'm just going to list these and just give a little description of what they are. And you can see that hermeneutics is complicated. You know, finding the meaning of a text involves a great many different kinds of lines of inquiry. And reality is probably somewhere in the middle of all of these, or the conglomeration of all of these. So let me just dive in. The first one I have is a lexical syntactical hermeneutics. And heavy words, lexical syntactical. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about the dictionary definition of these words, right? So whether that Bajoran symbol means eat fruit or means suffer horribly, yes. You know, that's a lexical syntactical question. What does the grammar of the language mean? What are the definitions of the terms involved? And that's one way of asking this question, just going right back to the meaning of the original meaning of the language. But you can also have a broader historical or cultural analysis, and that's another form of hermeneutics, a historical or cultural analysis. What was going on in the history of the time? What was the culture like? How did these elements inform the meaning of what you're reading on the page beyond the purely literal dictionary definition or the grammatical meaning of the phrases or words involved? So appealing to the historical or cultural context. There's also a what's called a contextual analysis. And here, contextual analysis doesn't mean sort of historical context. It means contextual analysis in the sense of taking whatever you're looking at and looking at the broader context within the work itself. So if you look just at the meaning of that one symbol on that Bajoran tablet, that might be ignoring the rest of Bajoran prophecies, right? You don't want to take things out of context. It's like people who take a single Bible verse and quote that over and over and over again without, you know, appealing to, you know, the rest of the scripture surrounding it, right? You miss, you know, important parts, yes, of meaning if you're ignoring the context within the work itself. So I would say an in-work contextual, precisely, analysis. You know, if you're talking about religion, you can also do a theological analysis, right? You know, if you're talking about the Bible, for example, you might interpret the meaning in light of everything else you believe. What else does your religion hold? And Bajorans might do this too. What's the most plausible meaning of that stone tablet given everything else that the Bajorans believe, the rest of their theology, right? That can inform the most plausible interpretation of that particular piece of text. And finally, you can do what's called a literary analysis, right? You can view any of these sacred texts, including the Bajorans, as works of literature and look at them from a dramatic perspective or an artistic perspective, from an aesthetic perspective, from a metaphorical perspective, and view them as works of literature in that sense. So you can apply all the techniques of literary rhetorical analysis to those works as well. So you can see hermeneutics is complicated. It's not just a matter of asking what's the author's original intention, as if that's an easy question. It's not merely asking, what does it mean for me today?
Right.
It's this rich interplay of the original meaning of the words, the grammar, the historical and cultural context, the viewing the work as a totality, you know, not taking individual sections out of context, you know, letting it be informed by other things you believe, your worldview or your theology. And of course, because they're words on the page oftentimes or on a stone tablet, they can often be viewed in a completely different light as a work of literature and interpreted as a different kind of work altogether than the what it is ostensibly, right? You can read the Bible, for example, as a theological text, a sacred text, or you can read it as a work of literature because there are stories in there. You can apply all the criteria and techniques of analyzing and evaluating the work as a piece of literature. And you can do that with Bajoran texts, right? You know, they're sacred texts to the Bajorans. On the other hand, they're rich stories and prophecies, and you can analyze them as literature. And if you're not a believer, that's probably what you're going to do, right? If you're a believer in universe, if you're a Bajoran Vedic, you're going to be more motivated by a theological analysis of that text. Whereas if you're not a believer, if you're a skeptic like Dax, for example, you might be more inclined to read those as literary metaphors as opposed to stories that have some theological meaning. So it's very complicated. I think, you know, it's just you can sort of oversimplify what's involved in interpreting something. I hope we gave a quick account of the many different directions you could go when analyzing some sort of a text. And of course, you can apply all of this to Star Trek, right? You can analyze the meaning of the words in the scripts in Star Trek. And what they mean to us today, what they meant in the 1960s. You can apply a historical and cultural analysis. What was the culture of the 1960s? What was going on geopolitically? And then what's happening to us today, and how can they inform each other? You can look at the works as a whole. Like, you can look at a single line of dialogue, or you can look at an episode, or you can look at a series as a whole, or you can look at Star Trek as a whole, right? So there's this broad spectrum of different sizes of context you could take into account. And, you know, what you think about a particular line of dialogue might vary based and how big of a sphere you're drawing around what you're considering at the time. You know, if you're a believer in one variety or another, if you have a theological worldview, you know, you might read Star Trek in light of other things you believe. If you have a certain political worldview, if you have a certain... Like, for example, if you're a Republican or a Democrat, if you're an individualist or a collectivist, right, you might read Star Trek very differently based on other things you believe. And I would say that's perfectly a fine thing to do, right? That's all part of bringing your own meaning into what you're seeing. What you don't want to do is read that back into the original intentions, though, right? It would be very easy to say, you know, because I'm a radical collectivist, right, you know, I'm going to read Star Trek as this, you know, radical collectivist metaphor from the beginning and say that was Gene Roddenberry's intention. Or if I'm an individualist, I'm going to say, okay, because I'm an individualist, that's what I see in Star Trek. That must be what Gene Roddenberry really meant, right? That would be a bit of a mistake. And of course, you know, because these are works of art, you know, it's not literature, but it's an artistic form, a different medium. It's television and film. You can apply, you know, all the techniques of dramatic and artistic analysis to Star Trek and view it as a work of art. So you can apply any of these techniques to any sort of sacred text or any book or any novel in universe. You know, you can ask these questions about what these prophecies mean, and outside the universe in this real world, you can look at Star Trek as a whole and say, what does Star Trek mean in light of this rich tapestry of different shades of meaning?
Yeah, we do have to be very careful not to read our own individual interpretation back into the original intent. And I think that is something that happens far too often with Star Trek. And oftentimes it becomes a source of conflict. There are a lot of discussion boards that I just don't frequent, you know, because they have these sort of arguments. We try to stay away from those kind of conversations. In the Babel Conference, we try to make sure that those conversations are fair and open, you know, open for everybody. And we invite people to share their thoughts and opinions, as long as it doesn't, you know, become derogatory or demeaning in any way. But, you know, a lot of the conflict occurs when people try to read their own interpretation back into the original intent. And there's just so much to consider, and you're absolutely right. You hit the nail on the head. Hermeneutics is very complicated, and it goes far beyond. I think the very base principle of hermeneutics is asking these questions, you know, what was the original intent and what does it mean now? But you're absolutely right. There's so much more to it. And when you talk about the meaning of words, there's actually a really great a kind of real world example of how just going along with what you were talking about with Jadzia, you know, are they going to suffer horribly or eat fruit? There's actually a really good real world example that I have for that. It's actually an account that's in the Old Testament. The present King Saul is, you know, in conflict with the future King David. And the Bible says that King Saul goes into a cave, and it says that he went in to cover his feet. And so you interpret that literally, and you say to yourself, well, what's that all about? He went in to, you know, were his feet cold? You know, you ask these sort of questions. When in reality, what we're referring to there is King Saul literally went into a cave to use the bathroom. because it was customary according to Jewish law, and they couldn't get any kind of excrements or fecal or anything like that on them. So they literally would cover their feet. So when the writer was penning that, he says King Saul went in to cover his feet, and so. When we read that now and interpret it, oftentimes we miss the meaning of what was going on there. So when David comes in and finds him there, he literally caught him with his pants down. Well, not literally with his robe down. We can sometimes read meaning into that's not there. But
It sounds to me like it's a bit like that episode Darmok from The Next Generation, where the literal words are what they are, but there's this rich metaphorical meaning. You can't just keep going back to the words because the words don't tell you the full picture, especially in this metaphorical sense, right?
Well, we are kind of rolling up on an hour here, and I thought to kind of close out our conversation, we'd touch on a few other examples in the Star Trek universe of hermeneutics in universe.
Yeah, Mike, the other area where this seems to come up inside the Star Trek universe for me is when the characters in Star Trek have to do some interpreting themselves, when they have to interpret Federation law or Starfleet regulations. And it's one thing to think, you can kind of apply this sort of literalist criterion to these examples, right? What are the literal meanings of the words in the law? What are the literal meanings of the regulations? But then without fail, you see that especially captains on the starships have to do some interpreting, right? Or Sisko, as commander of Deep Space Nine, has to take the orders he's been given, the principles he's been handed down, look at the situation at hand, and apply some interpretation to make it all come out okay at the end of the day. And so I'm thinking of things like, when you've got a certain order or a certain principle, a certain regulation, whether it's the prime directive or whether it's a particular order, how loosely or how strictly do you interpret that order, right? Like, for example, in fact, Mike, can you think of a good example inside Star Trek of where there's a loose interpretation of the orders or a strict interpretation of the orders, sort of kind of reading it just a little differently for the sake at hand, for the situation at hand?
Yeah, Zachary, it occurred to me, it's actually an example from the original series, the Menagerie, in which Spock has committed mutiny. He's taken the Enterprise, to this forbidden planet. And, at the end of the episode, they ultimately get an order saying, that it's okay to go there. But, we find this dilemma actually a lot in which the crew is going somewhere or doing something, and they're thinking to themselves, this is in conflict or contradiction of our orders, and at the end of the episode they get bailed out. But that's one example that comes to my mind.
Yeah, it seems like this discussion happens whenever the situation calls for violating an order, right? Because you don't want to sort of...
Do we go into the neutral zone?
Yeah, that's the situation I'm thinking of exactly. Every time the crew considers going into the neutral zone, they're faced with this question. Strictly speaking, we're not supposed to do this, but the situation at hand calls for doing it. So maybe if we read the situation a little different or generalize, get to the principle behind the order, not the letter of the order, then it'll be okay and we're justified in doing what we're doing. It does strike me a little bit like justifying your actions kind of after the fact, right? bending the rules and justifying it later seems like what's going on. But I guess that what I'm getting at here is the difference between the spirit versus the letter of the law, right? And any kind of legal interpretation is going to have this issue. You see this playing out in the real world here with different interpretations of the Constitution, right? The originalists versus the people that think the Constitution is a living document, right? Strictly speaking, the letters on the page say blah, 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 blah. But what the principle behind that in some looser, broader sense or in some more universal sense is this. And that kind of interplay between what the words on the page actually say and how it should be interpreted in some non-literal sense is a hermeneutical question. And you can see this playing out inside the Star Trek universe with different orders, right? Well, strictly speaking, the order means this, but the outcome we really want is this, or the universal principle at play is this, or the ethical principle at play is this. So let's go into the neutral zone, right? At the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And often, I think another area where this comes up is interpreting the Prime Directive, right? You know, insofar as the Prime Directive is the highest law in Starfleet, the highest principle, the General Order Number One. You know, strictly speaking, you're not supposed to do blah 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 with the Prime Directive. You know, there's all these criteria for when you're allowed to make first contact and when you're allowed to, what kinds of interactions you're allowed to have and whatnot. But, you know, the situation at hand might call for a looser interpretation of the Prime Directive for the sake of achieving a certain outcome.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite examples of that is actually Star Trek Into Darkness. Do they ignite this cold fusion device and stop this, you know, volcano? And do we take the Enterprise out of the water? Do we go get Spock? And so, you know, they're answering all these questions. In the end, you know, James Kirk gets a dressing down from Christopher Pike, but it's funny because you watch that episode and you go, makes sense to me.
Mike, I'm so glad you mentioned Star Trek Into Darkness, because I think that that movie in particular, while it's not one of my favorite Star Trek movies, I feel like fans don't give it its due. There is some good philosophical material in it. There's good metaphors. There's good contemporarily relevant material inside Star Trek Into Darkness. And none of it gets talked about very much because the movie kind of fails in other ways. But one of the things I love is the discussion between Pike and Kirk after Kirk has been discovered to have essentially violated the Prime Directive, radically intervened in the natural course of evolution on this world. And Kirk makes the claim in that movie that, you know, what he's doing is restoring the natural evolution. How can this culture evolve if they don't exist anymore, right? If they're wiped out, the natural evolution of their culture is gone. He's preserving the natural evolution of that culture, not violating it, right? But, and again, you know, Pike basically says, you know, that's not going to fly. You're playing fast and loose with the meaning of the principles here to justify what you've done. But it's this really fast, it's not a very long discussion. It's just, you know, 60 seconds or so, but it is this really interesting hermeneutical discussion about the meaning of the Prime Directive and what its intended meaning is. Is a Prime Directive designed to help preserve a culture, or is it designed to prevent Federation interference? And sometimes those are at conflict with each other, and you need to, for any particular situation, you might need to resolve it. You know, what's more important in this situation? Is it to not intervene at all costs, or is it to intervene in such a way that you find the balance and let a culture evolve according to its natural means? I'm thinking of another incident in Star Trek. Like if there's going to be like what's that episode where there's it's like, which episode of The Next Generation? This happens like 10 times in The Next Generation. There's this moon or an asteroid that's going to crash into this planet, and they've got to figure out how to not let the moon or asteroid crash into the planet. It's this plot device that's used again and again and again in The Next Generation.
I'm getting in the habit of thanking you, Picard.
Yeah, I was trying to think of which episode that was, and it occurred to me, okay, that's like 15 episodes probably. Exactly. But, you know, that's a great question. You know, strictly speaking, not intervening would be let the natural world evolve according to its own devices, right? If the moon is going to crash into the planet and that's going to wipe out this a species and it's going to end all life on the planet, that's mm-hmm. the natural course of events. So you don't intervene. You just let it happen, however much that might violate our sense of morality. But usually what happens is that someone in the Enterprise will go, wait a minute, we can't let all these people die. That's a terrible outcome. Really what's happening is that there's this intervening factor that is destroying the natural balance rather than preserving it. And so we need to intervene and get that out of the way. We need to move the moon or move the asteroid or destroy it or get Q involved or something, right? And so intervening in an active sense is the way to do, and that's the proper interpretation of the Prime Directive in those situations. So even with something as fundamental as the Prime Directive in Star Trek, there's this really radically interpretive element. Which is more important, to not intervene at all costs or to intervene in the right kind of way to preserve whatever's important about a particular culture or world or whatever? So that's my take on interpreting the Prime Directive, that even something as fundamental as that in Star Trek needs interpretation. I think, you know, in universe, the Bajorans, even as something as fundamental as what their sacred texts say, there's some interpretation in the real world. There's things like, what does the Constitution say? What do religious texts say? What does Star Trek mean for us? And there's an interpretive element through and through. But then the question is, it still has to be well-reasoned. It still has to be plausible. What I'm not saying is that any subjective interpretation goes. You still need to have a well-grounded interpretation. And I put together just a small list of things I think of are important when you are doing kind of this hermeneutical analysis, trying to understand the meaning of something. Just principles to keep in mind. You know, they're easy to forget if you're not paying attention to them. One thing is to stay well grounded in the text at hand, right? If you're like in universe, if you're giving an interpretation of the Prime Directive that is not sticking closely to what the Prime Directive actually says, then you're out in left field and you're giving an interpretation that's not plausible anymore. If the Bajorans, if some Bajoran gives some Bajoran Vedic maybe gives a radically different interpretation of those sacred texts that's not grounded in the texts themselves, that's not a plausible interpretation anymore because it contradicts what's in the text itself. In the real world here, if you're trying to give a new interpretation of the meaning of the Constitution, for example, mm-hmm. and you're not staying well grounded in what the words on the page actually say, then you're probably not giving a very plausible interpretation of that document. So just staying well grounded in the original source material is very important. I would say don't ignore the original meaning of the language at hand, right? So, you know, whatever the Prime Directive meant to the people who wrote it, you know, that's an important thing to take into account. But that's not to say be limited by it. You know, don't forget about it. Don't ignore it, but don't be limited. Try to understand it if you can. Don't ignore all the biases and context of your contemporary situation, but try to get as close as possible to the meaning of the original language as your starting point. Similarly, don't ignore the author's original intentions, but don't be bound by them either. So, and again, this is the Venn diagram that we talked about at the beginning of the show. You know, sure. There's this intersection between the original creators of the work's intentions, and then what you bring to the table today, or your society, or culture, or context brings to the table, and the interplay between the two is important. So, you know, don't forget about the original meaning, but don't be bound by it either. Don't be afraid to find new meaning and new shades of meaning for yourself or for your society, for your time period, right? And we do this with Star Trek, right? You know, without a doubt, over the next 20 years or 50 years, they're going to be new world events, new experiences that all of us Star Trek fans have, and we're going to keep going back to, you know, episode one of the original series. We're going to keep going back to the cage, and we're going to find new meaning in that based on what's happening in the contemporary world. And it's good and right that we do that, but we don't want to forget about what it really did mean for folks in the 1960s. And I would say the last sort of a caveat I have here is that you should always try to be aware of your own biases and prejudices. And that's very hard for anyone. You know, most of us have tunnel vision. We're not always self-reflective. We don't always understand the hidden factors that are driving us subconsciously or socially or culturally. But be as self-reflective as possible. Try to be as aware as you can of the biases that you have and the context that you have, so you can try to really separate what you're bringing to the table versus what the original creator or the original time period is bringing to the table. So you can really talk about all this interesting intersection between the two, right? If you start to conflate the two because you're not aware of your own biases, then you run the risk of just reading into those original works, whether it's a Star Trek episode or a religious text, the things that aren't really there that you're bringing to the table. So you want to be as self-aware as you can of those factors so you can keep separate things separate. So those are my sort of words of advice for how to do hermeneutics and how to talk about meaning in some intelligent sense. And it's amazing how badly this goes. You know, any sort of argument between Star Trek fans about what Star Trek really means, and sort of an irony quotes, the real meaning of Star Trek, what Gene Roddenberry really thought was this, right? And this can devolve into an argument between fans very quickly. And I guess the thing that presents that is the humility of your own perspective, recognizing that you aren't Gene Roddenberry, that you weren't there in the 1960s, you weren't in that writer's room when they were talking about what the original meaning was. And so there's however much you'd think you do understand those things, there's an interpretive element to it. There's things you're bringing to the table that you probably don't understand because you're maybe not being as self-reflective as you should be, or even are able to be. And so just try as much as possible to take the perspective of humility when you're trying to analyze the original meaning of something, because you weren't there from the beginning.
I think you're exactly right, Zachary. And, just to kind of put a final point to this conversation, I think there are a few really good examples in the Star Trek universe where we see kind of hermeneutics in action. And I just want to list a couple of these, and we can just kind of do a quick lightning round. We don't have to, no major discussion, because I know we're at about an hour and 20 minutes here. But I think about a piece of the action from the original series, season 2. Episode 17, in which the crew of the Enterprise come across a planet who have interpreted a 1930s gangster novel as a means of organizing their society. So their entire society operates like the gangsters of Chicago in the 1930s, you know, to the point that, you know, Spock finds himself really at an impasse. He says to Dr. McCoy, you know, logic and practical information do not seem to really apply here. And, you know, Bones says to him, he says, you're actually going to admit to that? And, you know, Spock says, well, to deny the facts would be illogical. So yeah, that's just how often left field they've gotten. And what a great example, Zachary, of what can happen when we take a text. In this case, they took a 1930s gangster novel, and they crafted their entire society around the letter of what this book was about. And, you know, in the end, their entire society resembled, you know, the gangsters of the 1930s.
It sounds like that episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation. Is it The Royale?
The Royale.
The Royale. Right.
Yes.
Exactly. Right.
This season 2, episode 12, I think.
Recreation of this bad pulp novel was
yes.
has become the you know, the prison or the cage within which the drama unfolds. They can't get out of. But yeah, it all starts with a bad novel from Earth. So.
Yeah, that one was an act of benevolence for an astronaut, and in doing so, they thought this kind of you know, seedy Las Vegas drama that he had was representation
home.
Just like home.
It sounds a bit like what Star Trek Las Vegas might feel like later this year. Just watch The Royale if you're gearing up for Star Trek Las Vegas.
And Christopher Jones shows up and buys the hotel. Another great example, actually, there are two really good examples from Voyager. And I'm thinking of Tinkerton or Dr. Spy, season 6, episode 4, in which an alien species misinterprets the doctor's daydreams and believes that that's actually real life. And so they think the doctor is quite a guy.
You know, it's interesting. What I don't like about these examples is the fact that there's really a mistake that's being made on the part
sure.
of interpreters, right? You know, the creators of the world you see in Casino or in the Royale got something wrong about mankind, right? And likewise, in that episode of Voyager, you know, the doctor's you know, dreams or daydreams are just, you know, that's not real. There's a mistake that's being made. It's an obvious misinterpretation. We can just say that's a misinterpretation and they've got it wrong and you're wrong.
Yes.
And most of the time, hermeneutics is not like that, right? You're talking about competing interpretations that are more or less plausible, different plausible interpretations of the very same text. You know, and there's no obvious mistake that's being made. You're talking about different interpretations that are, they contradict each other, so they can't all be true, but it's not clear that anyone's making a mistake. Whereas I think in those examples you just mentioned, you can sort of point to the creators of the mistake and say, nope, that's just wrong. You made a mistake. Yeah, they've got a text, they're reading something into it, but they got something just fundamentally wrong there.
Sure. Sure. And I think that's my point, Zachary. And the Voyager conspiracy is another one that comes to mind, where Seven of Nine is downloading ship's logs and data. And, you know, she's reading all of these conspiracies into what she's taking mm-hmm. in. And that's really my point in kind of pulling these episodes out. They're really good examples of what not to do. Honestly, you know, in terms of hermeneutics, they're good examples of mistakes, I think, that oftentimes we make when we're viewing Star Trek, for instance. We make obvious mistakes. We misinterpret. We read in. We don't understand. At least in the it always kind of cracks me up when and I don't mean to be general, paint with a broad brush, but you know it always seems like it's the 20-something that's watching the original series and just, you know, completely misunderstand the times, and they read things that aren't there, and they don't understand the context, and so they misinterpret, misread. And I think we even do this to some degree now with The Next Generation. I think we miss a lot of the original intent, original meaning, because we are, we're removed, you know, as you pointed out, going on 30 years from that particular episode. And I think it's really easy to forget, you know, what was going on in 1987 when that series first went on the air. And so I just kind of throw those out there. I think they're good examples of what not to do.
But I think the other side of that coin, Mike, is that, you know, younger Star Trek fans who may have not taken the time to appreciate the culture or the context of the original series or the Next Generation, right? We're talking 30 years ago or 50 years ago now, right? So it's very difficult to, while you can learn about it, you know, they've taken history courses and they know their parents or grandparents, right? It's not like they have no familiarity with it. So it's a spectrum, right? Of total ignorance of the culture of the 1960s and being well informed, all given that younger people literally weren't there, kind of by definition, right? But those younger fans can find new meaning in those old episodes of that you and I maybe don't understand, right? I think younger Star Trek fans than us, you know, I'm not old, I'm only 37, I'm not 60, I'm not 80, I'm not 100, right? But there's younger fans, you know, fans who are just teenagers or fans who are in their 20s, you know, their take on what Star Trek means is going to be a little different than mine based on their unique experiences and as part of a different generation. And I think it's right for them to find meaning that applies more to them or more to their generation that I may not be able to understand. It's a good thing. That's part of the hermeneutical process, I think, is each generation finding new meaning in these great works of literature, or in this case, great works of television and film entertainment that we know as Star Trek. So I think it goes both ways. You know, I think those younger people would benefit by trying to learn as much as they can about the original context of the original series and the Next Generation, the 60s and the 80s and the 70s, if we're talking about Saturday Morning Trek, one of our other podcasts on Trek FM. But it would also behoove us to be a little more open to new shades of meaning from those younger fans. I think there's a tendency to get a little curmudgeon-y when you're old, right? Like, I know what Star Trek means. Like Dr. McCoy, right? You know, these young whippersnappers on this new fangled ship, right? With these transporters I don't like. You know, there's a tendency to kind of not be open to new ideas. And in fact, even what's that... It comes up in one of the Star Trek movies when Kirk tells Scotty, young minds, new ideas, be tolerant. Where does that come up?
I'm not sure.
Young minds, fresh ideas, be tolerant. Yeah. And so I think that's the, regardless of where it shows up, I think that's the basic idea. You know, all of us slightly older fans could be a bit more open to different ways of interpreting this thing we know and love as Star Trek based on experiences that we haven't had as part of a different generation.
Yeah, and I think my point is we just need to be cautious not to apply those new meanings to the original intent of Gene Roddenberry, or, you know, to the particular writer, whether it's Gene Kuhn or DC Fontana or even Brandon Braga, if you want to kind of span up to the, you know, to more modern times. I think we just need to be cautious, you know, not to apply that new meaning to original intent, not to muddy that water. I think we have a tendency to do that too often.
Exactly. It's really hard to keep separate things separate there in that sense. We should try, but we know, but also recognizing we're always going to fail a little bit because we are stuck in our own context.
Yeah. Muddy Trek.
Muddy Trek. Exactly.
Muddy Trek.
Well, Mike, do you have anything to add in the way of final thoughts before we call it an episode?
I really don't, not beyond anything that I've already said. I think this is a fascinating discussion in the context of, you know, the time that we're living in, where we're going back and rediscovering Star Trek here on this, you know, auspicious occasion of the 50th anniversary of the original series. And so I thought it was timely, you know, for us to have this kind of conversation. I think it's very relevant, you know, in the Star Trek universe, because Star Trek does really in ways, again, that I don't feel any other franchise, at least for me. I'm sure someone on the Babel Conference will mention their favorite franchise and call me out on this, but for me, I just don't think there's another franchise out there, at least for me, that lends itself to this kind of perennial longevity in terms of, you know, what it meant then and certainly what it means now. How about you, Zachary? Any final thoughts?
Well, not too much beyond what I already had to say in the course of the episode, but I think I love this topic because this is part of what it means to get older. You know, I'm 37 years old. I'm not quite midway through life's journey here, right? And I'm already a little amazed at how fun and interesting and a little disappointing it is in aging, growing older. You know, I think one phrase that comes to mind is Spock's phrase, there are always possibilities. And, you know, as I age and get a little older and hopefully a little wiser, I'm just amazed at how much my perspective changed and my experiences changed, my personality's changed in ways, and yet I'm still the same person. I can look back and see, okay, as a Star Trek fan, I've been a fan, you know, pretty much my entire life since I was a really little kid. And I can keep circling back and finding new meaning. I can find new modes of enjoyment of things that are threads in my entire life. And yet a lot changes, and, you know, what you don't want to do is get stuck. I think, you know, you don't want to get stuck just merely rewatching those old episodes, stuck in your worldview, not being open to new ideas, new possibilities. And so in my mind, this hermeneutical problem in the course of a human lifetime just comes up again and again and again. You know, in 5 more years, I'll have a few more experiences. I'll do something a little different. Maybe I won't be doing this podcast anymore. Maybe I will, who knows, right? You know, whatever events in the world are going to happen, they're going to happen. And it's, you know, whatever it's going to happen in real life, you know, with friends or relationships or whatever, things happen, right? And you have to keep circling back and revisiting them and asking, what does all of this mean? and Star Trek, I think you're right, it's a much more long-lived franchise for me than other franchises, because I can keep finding new meaning in it, new ways of enjoying it, things I didn't see before, applications to my own life or applications to the world, or ways of combining things that seem like they're separate, like the Star Trek and philosophy idea. That's a hermeneutical idea inherently. This show is a hermeneutical show, right? We're taking the drama of Star Trek and the action of Star Trek, the stories that we love, and we're finding new meaning that may or may not be there, right? Either it's there originally and the writers put it there, or it's relevant because we're making connections that other people haven't seen, or maybe they have, and we're talking about it in a different way. That's an inherently hermeneutical idea. But to me, it's tied up with this progression of life. You know, every year that goes by, every month, every year, every decade is a different context with different events and different experiences. And if you're self-reflective of a person at all, you're going to keep looking back and trying to reinterpret past events in your own life. You're going to reinterpret things you enjoy. In terms of Star Trek, you're going to keep reinterpreting those episodes that you know and love. And that's just part of what it means to be a self-reflective individual who's turning your mind's eye inward a bit and trying to understand, you know, what is ultimately the question of the meaning of life. What does it all mean? And Star Trek does as good a job of asking this question as any franchise, right? What is the meaning of life? What's the meaning of humanity? What's the meaning of the universe? And so as much as Star Trek touches on these other philosophical concepts, you know, metaphysics and ethics and whatnot, Star Trek ultimately asks the question, what is the meaning of life? What does it all mean? So Star Trek and the discussions about Star Trek and the perspectives and interpretations of Star Trek are inherently hermeneutical. And if you don't take that approach, you run the risk of being stuck and not seeing those possibilities that Spock mentioned in that quote, there are always possibilities. So that's my final thoughts. You know, stay young, as Steve Jobs would have said, stay young and stay foolish, and keep keeping those eyes open and looking for new possibilities and new shades of meaning, and don't get too stuck in your ways, especially as you look back and interpret Star Trek. It's right for these young fans to come along and find new meaning that you and I can't see. So stay young. That's my final thoughts.
And continue to listen to Metatrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast, where we will continue to try to determine whether or not we're going to suffer horribly or eat fruit.
I'm eating fruit. I don't know about you. I hope I don't suffer too horribly. I'll err on the side of eating fruit every time.
I will eat fruit every time as well. Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about hermeneutics and Star Trek, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, the Orb.
The Wadi, a fun-loving race from the Gamma Quadrant, arrive at DS9 eager to play a game with Sisko and the crew, one that appears to be a matter of life and death. All right, so are we moving along, Matthew?
Oh, we're moving along.
The Ready Room.
He's carrying the lamb chop sock puppet saying,
She stayed at her post.
While Charlie Horse ran.
While Charlie Horse ran.
To the journey!
My last one, I think I might get a little bit of grief from you. Workforce, part one.
Oh my God.
I know. Hey, I did not make fun of Fairhaven.
That's because Fairhaven's good and Workforce is boring.
Oh, bite me.
Commentary, Trek stars.
You know, you come up with something stupid because of some joke that someone said and someone else said, and then all of a sudden you're doing a tournament of movies which J.J. Abrams produced to determine which one is the crappiest.
The 602 Club.
We start getting hints of Thor, we start getting hints of Cap, we start getting hints of the entire Avengers crew, and we get Black Widow. So, I mean, Iron Man 2, considering how maybe that's not my favorite movie of the MCU, really does set up a lot of what is to come.
Literary Treks.
You know, visually, to me, this is one of my favorite eras of Star Trek. You know, those monster maroon coats they're wearing, and they're just absolutely gorgeous. And, you know, a lot of people talked about wanting to get a Captain Sulu Star Trek series, and one of the big reasons for me that would be so great is to see this era played out visually on a regular basis.
Women at Warp.
Her voice as a computer voice has become so iconic that when Google started developing what is now known as Google Now, that personal assistant you can speak to, they had initially codenamed it Google Majel.
That's so cool.
Isn't that awesome?
Meta Trex.
And I kind of had the jingle in my head, you can be a winner at the game
yes.
of life. And I was trying to think of the Star Trek version of that. You know, you can be a winner of the poker game of life on the Enterprise. It didn't really roll off the tongue, so.
It was great until you added on the Enterprise.
Melodic Treks.
The reason why I think Brian Reitzel would be a more plausible choice is because he has worked with Fuller in the past. They worked together on Hannibal. He scored that series, all 39 episodes. The neat thing about Brian Reitzel's music is it's more of a sound design than it is a score.
Saturday Morning Trek.
One of the characters is sizably larger than the other.
So he's just closer to the camera, Aaron, obviously.
But he's actually behind the other person.
He's a giant.
Wait, then he doesn't need a laser cutter. He can just lift the hatch up with it. Go down and get it.
Okay.
Continuing mission.
Yeah, and of course, another great thing is when it's all finished and you look at it and go, yeah, we made that together. Yeah, that's one of the greatest moments. And people respond to it and say, oh, that's pretty well made. The effects are great. The actors are great, even though they're Dutch trying to speak English, right?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these and other shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us tremendously, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the shows as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks that we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and entry into the patron zone, as well as many others. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything that we've discussed in this Metatrex episode or any of our previous episodes, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us from our website, go to trek.fm/contact.
If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar in our show page on the Trek FM website or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
Our Twitter handle is @trekfm.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/trekfm and find us in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Just type Babel into the search field on Facebook, that's B-A-B-E-L, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We'd also like to invite you to leave a rating and review of Metatrex on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. And if you give us heads up, we might even read your review right here on the show. Well, Zachary, when you're not contemplating what this is all going to mean 50 years from now, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Absolutely. You can find me on Facebook and the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. And you can also find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, Zachary Fruhling. That's ZacharyFruhling. And Mike, how about you? Where can our listeners find you on the internet and around the Trek FM network these days?
You can also find me around the Babel Conference and on Facebook, on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatrex team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau, art director Aaron Harvey, our content manager Will Wen, our production manager Richard Marquez, and our fabulous editor and producer Dennis Castello. Well, thanks everyone for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.